At the dawn of the ninth year of the Siege of Rex, initial projections had put the 88th Siege Army as having sundered the two outer rings of heretic defenses, and being firmly entrenched in operations against the final barriers, in sight of the citadel itself, and with the lair of the treacherous Cardinal Astra in range of their most powerful long-range artillery. This was, however, not the situation reality had deigned to allow. While the recent actions of the Dark Angels chapter of the Adeptus Astartes had injected fresh hope into the minds of Imperial strategos, the besieging army of the Imperium had far eclipsed its initial death toll estimates, and had been forced to request more arms, armaments, and manpower to continue its fight. Lord Zwelk, himself frequently more besieged by expectations and steadily climbing casualty rates, devised plans for what he believed would be a decisive breakthrough to capitalize on the actions of the Dark Angels. A whole new line corps, consisting of three fresh regiments, arrived on world to provide field officers on the ground the supplementary manpower they would need to mount what Zwelk routinely referred to as an unstoppable offensive to his senior officers. A sort of content apathy was believed to have gripped the hearts of the line commanders by this year of the siege, if records from the time are to be trusted. The Krieg had fallen into a routine, one of holding the line, harassing the enemy where possible, and seizing upon opportunities to make small-scale, often quite fleeting gains. This had become unacceptable to Zwelk, and the time frame the siege had been prescribed to take place under. Strictly speaking, the Lord Commander of the 88th had only 3 more years to complete operations. This timetable, given present circumstances, was exceptionally unlikely, unless some major disruption was effected. The new line corps, and many already on station, were ordered en masse to plan and deliver a massive assault, a total commitment offensive to apply substantial pressure upon all fronts of the heretic lines. It was Zwelk's hope that the entire defense cordon, when pushed simultaneously, would open up breaks, ones that the Imperial Army would capitalize on with the rapid redeployment of an entire assault corps held in reserve. In an ideal circumstance, the assault corps would rush the inner defense line too, and effect a breach in the final cordon itself. The start of the new offensive was pinned at 101-822-M41. Preparations were clearly visible to the defenders of Rax, while the logistical work of stockpiling ammunition and the movement of artillery batteries took place far from the front lines. Observation posts of the militia could not fail to notice the influx of transports arriving in Imperial trenches, and the sudden uptick in mine-clearing operations in No Man's Land. Heretic artillery responded with harassing attacks, attempting to disrupt these operations, shelling incoming convoys and identified barrack zones in the hopes of bleeding Krieg troops further. The canniest traitor commanders attempted to pick off Krieg artillery batteries, knowing that with the upcoming assault, whensoever it should fall, would be heavily reliant on the big guns of the Emperor of Mankind. In this, the heretics were entirely accurate. The Grand Assault's planning consisted of one of the most sophisticated artillery plans yet devised by the 88th Siege Army, a massive undertaking requiring careful coordination across a myriad of roles, from the harrowing of enemy infantry in the trenches, to the laying of smoke, to counter-battery identification and destruction. This was undertaking in concert with the strategic forward planning of infantry platoons, whose officers were expected to leverage all available intelligence to identify primary, secondary, and tertiary objectives within their specific target sectors, and to submit them to battalion and regiment headquarters for examination. The tension, building for weeks, was reaching a fever pitch, a furiously relentless hive of activity that, eventually, must break. And break it did, for on 089-822-M41, the preliminary bombardment commenced. Every gun in the 88th Siege Army spoke, lighting the dull Vrax sky with muzzle flashes as they poured high explosives upon the hated heretics of the militia. All day and all night the guns fired, in an attempt to break down the defenders' resistance, while in the trenches, Kriegers mustered in their hundreds of thousands. They filled the forward trenches, then the auxiliary trenches, then the communication trenches, then the transit trenches. Behind even this force, a second wave was readying itself. As the atmospheric disruption of such a concentrated and sustained artillery duel began to provoke Vraxian lightning storms, as flames lit the Van Meersland's wastes, the siege army of the Imperium prepared a force of over 2 million infantry to begin the attack. As the weakness of dawn attempted to break the cloud, it was obscured by the choking smoke of the bombardment. At predetermined chrono marks, the guns increased their tempo, pouring shells onto the defenders in a final, almost desperate surge, before, as one, falling into moments of silence. The now familiar scene began, Krieg soldiers rushing up muddy ladders as they went over the top, pouring out of their trenches into the fires of no man's land. The only difference now was scale. A tidal wave of bodies hurled themselves at the enemy, the silence following the bombardment now taken up by battle cries and the pounding of boots into churned earth. Pre-sighted batteries of enemy artillery opened up, those that had not been obliterated in 4 days of Imperial barrages, hurling fury at the incoming horde. As the guns beat down their punishment, the killing began in earnest. In Sector 5045, artillery fire from No Man's Land triggered the complete collapse of the 158th Regiment's attack. The first wave retreated in the face of an intense enemy bombardment, the Imperial artillery having largely failed to destroy most anything of its opposing batteries in that zone. Prefectus commissars embedded in the Krieg squads roared for the soldiers to rally and push forwards, summarily executing those that broke to flee towards Imperial lines. Records filed by loyal throne subjects attest that several commissars were shot by their own side as the crippled assault companies ran for comparative safety. This wholesale retreat caused significant problems back at Imperial lines. The fleeing Krieg were met by the waiting second wave, stepping up to the trench lips to begin their own attack. The advancing and retreating units collided, filling the trenches with more soldiers than could reasonably be expected to accommodate. Internecine fighting, bitter and desperate, broke out as Krieg officers from the second wave attempted to force their men forwards, scuffles throwing soldiers into the mud where several suffocated. Only 2 hours into the grand assault, and the 158th Regiment's attack had disintegrated utterly into nothing but shambles. The failure, at a politically sensitive time for high command, elicited a harsh response. The regiment's colonel and his staff were rapidly arrested and executed for supreme dereliction of duty. The regiment itself was disbanded by the 88th Army's commissars, many seeking revenge for the deaths of their fellows. The survivors of the debacle were ultimately sentenced to serve amongst the Astra Militarum's penal legions. Other sectors, happily for the Imperial Command, saw better coordination and success. In their archetypal way, the Krieg pushed forward despite the horrendous losses they were suffering. The sheer quantity had a quality of its own. Where Krieger platoons met the enemy lines, they swamped the heretic militia with sheer numbers. Bayonets stabbing, las guns cracking. The sheer size of the battle made it difficult to discern an overall strategic picture. Despite no decisive break having yet been forced, Imperial Command ordered the launch of a second wave attack, lest the momentum be drained away by attrition. As the assault proceeded, it became clear that most of the enemy had held. Where they had been overrun, the Vraxian militia had only retreated deeper into the defense line, manning new defensive positions. As the hours passed, it emerged that the Krieg's 34th Line Corps seemed to have achieved the most gains thus far. In the sector manned by the 291st Regiment, Imperial artillery had managed to achieve complete battlefield supremacy, obliterating all of the enemy's own batteries. This allowed the infantry, in turn, to overrun the enemy trenches, continuing their advances even as night fell upon the battlefield. Imperial Command seized upon this, rapidly issuing orders for this sector to be the focal point of the following day's attacks. The 11th Assault Corps, held in reserve for just such an occasion, were ordered into position to begin a fresh attack through the sectors forced open by the 291st Regiment. Despite preparation undertaken ahead of the Grand Assault, the 11th Assault Corps would require almost a full day to navigate into attack positions, meaning the 291st Regiment would have to hold their gains until this time, rendering the second day of Zwelk's gambit one of consolidation. Disjointed, uncoordinated attacks were mounted, primarily to ensure pressure remained upon the heretics. But these primarily amounted to little more than ground trading. A fortified bunker may be cracked and seized by the Krieg, while in turn, the heretics would bathe trenches in flamer waves, ultimately retaking their old positions. Krieger combat engineers were pivotal to Imperial successes on this second day. Where an attack had seized an enemy trench line, it was hurriedly sealed off at either end to prevent the heretics from attacking along the trench. Heavy weapons emplacements were then constructed, the guns dragged forwards and positioned as best they could to resist any possible counterattacks. In Sector 5650, the 8th Platoon of the 14th Company of the 158th Regiment, led by one Lieutenant Cada, was a prime example of just such an engagement. The lieutenant squads had been part of the second wave, a full-strength platoon of 60 Kriegers. The passage through No Man's Land had reduced this to 30, shellfire tearing the rest to bloody pulp. The lieutenant's bold and daring assault of a heretic heavy bolter emplacement had won the day, allowing the survivors to pour into the trench line and capture it in the Emperor's name. Now, it must be held. Artillery fire was still churning up the Vraxian earth near their positions, although as to which side was firing, it was impossible to tell. Day 2 dawned for the 8th Platoon. Along with the feeble light broke an enemy attack, the heretics seeking to recover their trench positions. The heavy weapon emplacements, primarily heavy bolters, were crucial in driving these back, although by midday, after hours of sustained fighting, Cada's ammunition reserves were becoming an issue. Enemy mortar fire was gradually becoming more frequent and more accurate. Lacking a vox caster, Cada and his aide retreated personally back into No Man's Land, sifting through the bloody ruins of their dead comrades for the operator's corpse, and hopefully their equipment. This they succeeded in finding, with the caster almost miraculously operational. Yet, to Cada's dismay, the company commander could not be raised, nor could the body of the company itself, which was supposed to be conducting operations close by. The only response came from the battery commander of a group of quad launchers, who relayed Cada's operations report back to command. The lieutenant was to ultimately pay for his efforts. An enemy sniper's bullet found a home in his neck just after the report had been delivered. The poor aide fled back to the platoon survivors, now a mere 19, with word of their lieutenant's death. But the loss was not in vain. Across No Man's Land came Centaur transports carrying Krieg grenadiers, relieving the poor 8th Platoon thanking them for their heroism and ordering them back to their own trenches. Small actions such as this one are archetypal of day two of the Grand Assault. Intimate, desperate dramas fought in their thousands across the full scope of the battlefront. However, they could not, even in their multitudes, affect the decisive break that Imperial Command was hoping to achieve. As the second day drew to a close, several regimental colonels began requesting that the Grand Assault be called off, or at the very least scaled down. Attrition rates for their regiments were staggering. Several warned that should this pace be maintained, these selfsame regiments would soon be unable to achieve combat functionality. Lord Commander Zwelk, however, would not, and by the word of some historators, could not, consider any of these requests. His offensive was too strategically and politically important to set aside for something as apparently inconsequential as death tolls. Many chroniclers, and one includes oneself within this group, believe that the Grand Assault was Zwelk's last throw of the proverbial dice, a move made, quite frankly, in a desperate worry of the overall state of the Siege of Rax. Should the Lord Commander accede to the requests of the regiments, he risked losing the one thing he had apparently been seeking to achieve, momentum. This had, over 9 years now, emerged as one of the most vital aspects of the war. The trench combat of Rax had a way of applying a simply staggering inertia to almost any offensive. Zwelk was wholly unwilling to let this occur this time, meaning he could not afford a delay of any sort, either for intelligence gathering or a detailed situational analysis to better understand the broader picture of his offensive. Day 3 would not relent. The assault would continue. By this day, the 11th Assault Corps were in place to capitalize on the best successes the 88th Siege Army had thus far won. Concentrating on sectors 5141 and 5241, a massive attack wave of Imperial armor churned through No Man's Land, and in their wake heavily fortified Gorgon transports of Krieg, each one containing a full platoon. The heretic enemy was now only holding a loose line of demolished bunkers, ringed with improvised dugouts and hastily fortified shell craters. They were simply overwhelmed by the Astra Militarum. These first thin lines could not hold back the tidal wave of Imperial forces, and by mid-morning, the tanks and infantry of the 11th Assault Corps were once again advancing. Some dared hope that this may be the break, that the second defensive line was finally breached in a way that would affect significant destabilization. But the militia's commanders were fully aware of the situation on the ground, and the risks it posed to their defenses. The initial breach forced by the 291st Regiment's victories was a dangerous threat to them. Reserve equipment and arms were now deployed in an attempt to stymie the Imperial gains. Liman Russ battle tanks, Chimera transports, Basilisk and Medusa artillery vehicles, even a squadron of 12 destroyer tank hunters emerged from hidden storehouses to attack the advancing 11th Assault Corps. The destroyers proved significantly effective. Soon, burning Krieg tanks lay everywhere, the fires of their demises only adding to the choking fumes of the ongoing artillery duel. The enemy's counterattack had the anticipated effect. By mid-afternoon, the Krieg were unable to continue advancing. Worse yet, in several areas, the enemy's armored assault was forcing them into retreat. Armor losses were mounting, and a defensive artillery barrage was hastily called in. The breakthrough, so yearned for, had failed. All, however, was not yet lost. Other sectors brought better word on the third day. To the extreme east of the assault theater, the 3rd Siege Regiment of the 1st Line Corps had finally achieved its day one objectives in Sector 6248, mustering itself for an advance in the coming morning, with armored support from the tank companies of the 14th Regiment. The minor gains must be pushed, the hastily sought-after breakthrough forced open, by the word of High Command. To any outside observers joining, it must have seemed the siege army was intent upon a suicidal push to its own destruction, shoveling men into the war as one may stoke an engine with coal. By the words of one anonymous regimental commander, it appeared for all the world that high command believed the best way to smash a wall was by headbutting it. A grim picture was slowly emerging, and it spoke of the ruin of the 88th Siege Army. It simply could not maintain the pace that Lord Commander Zwelk was demanding of it. The newly arrived regiments of the 46th Line Corps, those that had allowed Zwelk his gambit in the first place, had been significantly depleted in a mere 3 days of fighting. Momentum, the watchword of the week, was not to be denied, however. Command issued orders for the entirety of the 88th Siege Army to be committed. The only reserves allowed, those of the reconstituted companies being formed in the rearmost lines, from regiments slaughtered by the initial days of the Grand Assault. The offensive continued, relentless and unstoppably bloody, and it would do so for the next 3 days. Had Vrax been a meat grinder before, it was nothing to what it had become during the week of the Grand Assault. Stockpiles of ammunition, especially heavy artillery ammunition, were running into interruption as the guns bled the warehouses dry. Companies had been reduced to the size of platoons, platoons to the size of squads, squads to ribbons of flesh and splashes of blood in the ruins of no man's land. The Grand Assault was to be fought for 7 days, when, at 1:22, 8:22, M41, the 468th Regiment launched an attack on Sector 5750. Colonel Attas, commander of the regiment, had created a plan to mount a night attack against the enemy trench line currently facing him. In a stroke of coordination rendered impossible elsewhere by losses and lack of overall coherency, Attas made a new concerted assault with the totality of his regiment, in concert with surviving artillery batteries. Initially, command echelons were unwilling to permit the maneuver. It was believed that, with visibility rendered across vast swathes of Vrax to less than 100 meters, and the atmospheric disturbances playing havoc with Vox networks, that Attas simply could not pull off the plan that he had devised. It called for the colonel to personally lead the Krieg assault companies across No Man's Land, at night, utilizing sustained and punitive artillery bombardments as cover. This, combined with the lack of visibility on the ground, would ideally allow the assault companies to infiltrate across No Man's Land, their passage disguised from the enemy. The suppressing bombardment was not intended to inflict anything in the major way of damage. It was to keep the enemy's head down, forcing them to seek shelter. Once in position, the Krieg would remain hidden throughout the night until dawn, when the bombardment would shift both focus and intensity, now aiming to inflict actual casualties and structural damage. The most crucial aspect of the plan was its most challenging. As dawn broke, Attas would order the barrage lifted, moving it forward through the enemy trenches by approximately 50 meters, thus giving the Krieg an opportunity to attack enemy forward lines, while denying their rearward elements an opportunity to mount a counterassault. Once the forward trenches were seized, the colonel's second wave companies would then pass through the first wave, maintaining the assault. Colonel Attas petitioned command again and again, until they relented in favor of his reasoning. The attack was, ultimately, a spectacular success. This, in and of itself, is not a phrase one is able to employ often when discussing the Siege of Vrax. It would, however, cost the colonel his life. Heroically leading his men in a charge through an enemy trench line, the colonel was surprised upon by a mutant Ogryn, whose hammer caught him in the chest, shattering his rib cage and tossing his limp, mangled body a full 6 meters into the air, before crashing down in bloody ruin upon the mud. The fighting, at first savage, bled away into a sort of stunned conclusion. At one ruined bunker, a shell-shocked and dazed enemy platoon actually surrendered en masse without firing a shot. Despite the colonel's death, his subordinates ordered an immediate attack of the second wave, and at the very vanguard, the Krieg were suddenly through. There were no more bunkers, trenches, walls, barricades, or razor wire. The second defense line had been breached. News of the victory was immediately forwarded to high command, and sector commanders in the locale rushed to disengage their troops from other actions and reinforce the 468th Regiment. Initially dispatching a full battery of quad launchers, towed by their centaurs, more ground troops swiftly followed. Infantry platoons, armored corps supported by Gorgons, all flanked by squadrons of the Krieg's iconic Death Riders. As with the first major breakthrough achieved almost 8 years prior, the days following the breach in the second defense line saw the heretic trenches falling swiftly and brutally. The 88th Siege Army poured Krieg guardsmen into the breach in an unrelenting tide, and no counter-assault mounted by the Vrax militia could halt them. Again, as with before, defense lines became immediately untenable, their rears and flanks now open to Imperial assault. Relying on the efforts of suicidal rear guards, the Vrax militia forces withdrew wholesale, attempting to extract the bulk of their manpower and armaments behind the final trench ring. The 468th Regiment, now the vanguard of the Imperial assault, went on to capture the ruins of Hab Zone 2, and were soon embroiled in street fighting with the enemy. Any heretic who had not escaped encirclement were overwhelmed and destroyed, rode down by armored columns or Death Rider squads. This all being said, again, as just with the first breakthrough, there was not any possibility of rushing forwards against the final defense cordon. The siege army had been bled hard by the grand offensive, and needed significant time to rebuild, rearm, and prepare for the next phase of the siege. New trenches must be established, new artillery batteries, new logistics highways, new landing zones. It had taken 9 years and 4 million lives for this to be achieved. At an immense cost of blood and metal, equal in many ways to the worst war zones the Imperium was presently engaged in, victory appeared to be now achievable. Not only was the area of ground the siege army had to cover significantly reduced, but the citadel of Vrax was finally within range of the long-range artillery of the Militarum. Yet, within that very citadel, tidings dark and terrible were parlayed, and the traitorous Cardinal Zafan struck an accord. A pact was sealed in blood and souls. As the Krieg sentries took up their first watch within sight of the citadel, a storm, unlike those previously seen upon the world, blew up out of the wastelands, painting the sky in colors strange and uncanny. Its ferocity was equally strange, as was its position. The eye of it perched atop the citadel itself like a dark crown. Lightning broke from within, yet it did not strike the ground. Rather, it rose skywards, forked tongues seeking, seemingly, to pierce the atmosphere and touch the void itself. It was an omen most ill, yet how ill, none could possibly imagine. This video and this channel were made possible thanks to the very kind donations and support from my Patreon subscribers. If you'd like to help support the channel, head on over to patreon.com/oculusimperia. If you'd like to receive more updates about the channel and any future videos, you can contact me or follow me on Twitter @oculusimperia. Otherwise, please like, subscribe, comment, let me know your feedback, and as ever, thank you very much for watching.